Bob Swagger, and this is your survival guide to the economic meltdown. We'll be talking to some people today who have found some creative coping mechanisms to stay afloat, stay fed, and stay happy during the current recession. I'm sitting here in the studio with Professor of Political Economy at York University, Rufus Dean, and Italian sociologist Ornella Dossi from La Sapienza University in Rome. They'll be sharing some of their insights on what went down, who to listen to, and what to do now that the economic doo-doo has hit the fan. Tell us, Rufus, which social groups do you feel have been affected the most?
Well, if we're talking about the most, who've paid the greatest price, like I said, it's the people who always pay the greatest price. It's the poor, it's the people of color, it's the working class, it's the single mothers, it's the people who are the ones losing their homes, losing their jobs, who were never benefiting from the system in the first place. On the other side of it, you have the capitalists who, certainly, their wealth has been drawn down. But what does that mean? It means no more do you have $10 billion in value, now you only have $1 billion in value. And that level of being affected, I think, is qualitatively different from the person who no longer has a home, no longer has a job, no longer has much in the way of prospects coming out of an era where that's what everything was about. It was all about prospects. We were all capitalists now. We had done away with all of the negatives to the system, and we could all benefit from the enormous success that was being created. And the lies that were fed to us, the people that lied, well, they're still on top. And the people that were lied to, they're still on the bottom. So although this crisis is certainly important, really it's just an amplification of capitalism as usual.
How much do you think things like fear and panic play into the way that the economy functions?
The fear and panic are the other side of the exuberance that was driving all of the hype, all of the claims that we'd figured out how to eliminate the negatives, and it was only the positives, and people were buying into it, and that sent accumulation to record levels. The fear and the panic, they come on the other side of that. That's what we're seeing now. There are what are called the panic rules of the market. Rule number one, don't panic. Rule number two, panic first. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing everyone trying to panic first.
The ones who are at the bottom, what can they do about the situation?
I think the first thing that they have to do is they have to stop listening to the economists. They have to stop listening to the beneficiaries of the system, because they benefit precisely because we do listen and we believe them. We have to stop believing them. We have to start laughing in their faces at what should sound ridiculous, because it is ridiculous, because they have no idea how the system works. We need to start listening to ourselves, talking to our neighbors, and deciding what we actually value, because this entire system is about what gets valued, and what gets valued is power. And for you and I, who have no power, that means we have no value. So what do we actually want to value? And I'm not in a position to say. We can only answer that question together. And that's why we need to start talking to each other about these serious issues and not leave it to the so-called experts.
That was Rufus Dean, Professor of Political Economy at York University. This is very important stuff to keep in mind when we're hearing about the economic repercussions of the meltdown. Now let's hear from the ground and what's happening here in Toronto. Correspondent Alexa Wright is talking to people about how they're coping with the crisis.
Thank you, Bob. I'm Alexa Wright, CBC correspondent, and I'm on the street talking to David McNally. And he's got some very interesting insights on people dealing with the crisis in very creative ways in other parts of the world. David, could you share some of these ideas with us?
I'm happy to, Alexa, because one of the things that we're seeing in so many parts of the world right now is that people are more or less saying, if capitalism can't work for us, then we'll work without capitalism. That is to say, they're beginning to experiment with new ways of starting to organize their economic economic life. Take, for instance, the worker recovered enterprise movement in Argentina, where since 2001, workers have been saying that if the bosses are going to shut down their factories, they'll simply take over. They'll run them under workers' control. They'll start to produce socially useful products. They will begin to organize new and cooperative ways of producing the goods and services that our society needs. Or take the massive movements in both Brazil and Bolivia of landless workers who are simply seizing the unused lands of the large estates, organizing cooperative farms, setting up their own schools, and so on. Here we see creative responses where people are literally saying, we don't need employers, we don't need market competition, we can actually start running things under workers' self-management, producing the goods and services that communities need. These are creative responses to a capitalism in crisis. And we're beginning to see even little bits of this in North America. In early January, workers at Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago took over their factory when, although the employer had received all kinds of loans under the bailout program through the Bank of America, they decided they were simply going to shut down without giving workers their back pay, their severance pay, the holiday pay they were due, and so on. And the workers simply occupied. And interestingly, these were workers who had been part of the immigrant rights movement that had had the big May Day mobilization a couple of years earlier. And so what we're seeing even closer to home, like in Chicago or in Ontario, where although they don't want to broadcast it, we've had 9 factory occupations since this recession began. What we're seeing, in other words, is people taking direct action, taking over their places of work. And of course, in France, they've gone to the point where they're actually boss napping. That is to say, when they won't get adequate negotiations, they're taking their bosses hostage, holding them in the factories and saying, you've got to deal with us. You can't just throw workers out on the street as if we're nothing but used up commodities that you're discarding. We're human beings, we have rights, and we're going to assert them. So I think on all of these fronts, from Argentina to Chicago to the factory occupations that we've seen in Ontario to the very high levels of mobilization that we're seeing now in France, and of course to the landless workers' struggles in countries like Brazil and Bolivia, people are saying we don't need market capitalism, we don't need competition, we don't need the old ways that have gotten us into this crisis. There are new democratic participatory ways of reorganizing our economic life, and maybe that's the big lesson we want to draw from this crisis.
That's great, David. Thank you very much. I wish I would run into more people like you every day on the street.
Well, maybe we'll do that on May Day.
There you go, Toronto. It's about celebrating May Day this weekend. Back to you, Bob.
Listening to The Meltdown on CBC Radio 1. In Europe, groups are looking for ways to cope creatively with the crisis. We're talking to Ornella Dossi of Sapienza University in Rome. Tell us, Ornella, what are the most striking effects of the economic crisis in Europe?
Oh, hi, Bob. Well, I mean, there is a lot to say. What I want to say as a sociologist, I'm going to concentrate more on what the people are doing in Europe and how they are reacting to the measures, the economic new measures that are being implemented. There is two things that I find particularly interesting, and they're connected. There has been a huge wave of student protests in Europe. And so that we have had strikes in different countries. Italy had strikes for a long time, but we've had other kinds of rallies and demonstrations and protests in Croatia, in Greece. There were things in the UK, Germany. So one of the things that they're doing is basically they are refusing to let governments to cut funding on education with the excuse that, you know, like they need to save money on their budgets because of the economic crisis. And one of their arguments is obviously that this is a really short-sighted measure because, you know, by cutting down on resources to educate people, then you will soon have a new generation of people who are not going to be educated enough, will not have the skills to be able to you know, to revive the economy and to create new ways of functioning in within the European community. So that the so-called wave, this movement of students that moved all the way across, it was called the anomalous wave. It was like a tsunami that moved from Italy all the way across the north and went down to Spain and so on. They all took up the same kind of slogan, which was, "We will not pay for your crisis." And under that slogan, then they developed different kinds of initiatives that were not limited to protests, but actually went to organizing alternative sites where people can learn things. They were creating the infrastructure for students to have, you know, to save money and try and keep on studying and so on. And the other thing I want to focus on, which is actually really in theme with our May Day episode, is the actual Euro May Day parade. This is a movement that has been that was started in at the beginning of the 2001 and fast spread from Italy again all over Europe, and it basically sort of like coalesced around May 1st, you know, in order to revive the tradition of you know, the workers' movement. But what they're doing, these are not usual, you know, the usual people who want to have a class struggle, you know, like they're not advocating for the revolution or anything like this. What they're doing is basically trying to attract the attention to a consistent and increasing shift in our not only economic but social political lives, where our lives become more and more precarious. You know, our jobs are insecure, there is, you know, illegal immigrants who don't get recognized in the country and have to take on, you know, really bad jobs and have no way of reacting. You know, the welfare state, which was really strong in Europe, is sort of like going down. So people are talking about precarity all the time, the so-called, you know, like, it's this new name that they made up for, you know, describe the precarious life conditions. And what they're doing is they usually organize and set up structures and, you know, workshops and things all year round, and they network. But what they do on May Day is there is going to be basically a lot of events everywhere in Europe. This is going to be actually a lot of fun, because what they're doing, these are not aggressive people. These are people who are, you know, celebrating even the freedom to be able to do something else with their time, on the condition, obviously, that, you know, like, the working less will sort of like be balanced out by doing other kinds of activities that will help you live with less money. So there is going to be parades, there is going to be, you know, samba bands playing in the street. Milan is going to have a big demonstration, Madrid, but also smaller cities, you know, like Liège, and there is Terrassa in Catalonia, Helsinki, so everywhere. And even actually they have started networking with other countries outside of Europe, so there is going to be a May Day at the same time in Tokyo. Japan is taking up actually this kind of, you know, slogan again and this kind of practice, so that people are getting together. And the idea is, you know, like Rufus was saying, people are getting together, they're exchanging knowledge, they're exchanging practices, they're trying to make this, you know, like, more creative, more, you know, like, joyful in, you know, in the way in which they want to disagree with what is happening to us.
Thank you very much, Ornella Dosi of Sapienza University in Rome. Here in Toronto, there are groups that have been organizing local events happening around the city. Let's go back to Alexa, who's gone to find out where they are and where they're going to be getting it on over the next 2 days' festivities.
Thanks, Bob. This is Alexa Wright, CBC correspondent. I'm on the street talking to Sebastian Cartwright, and he's going to tell us what's going on over May 1st festivities, what's happening, and where you want to be this weekend.
Of course. You know, the May Day is the International Workers' Day. It started in the 1800s around immigrant workers sort of like mobilizing in Chicago. But in Toronto, May Day in the last 5 years has really been about migrant rights and about non-status people taking to the streets and organizing around it. We usually have a march followed by a cultural festival. This year it's sort of been switched around. So the cultural festival is the night before. So on the Friday night we're having this really like lavish party where we're having performances from almost every part of the world. We've got like contemporary dance, we've got theater, we've got an ongoing ongoing radio show, so people can sort of call in and participate. There's food, you know, it's just, it's going to be a great party. And then we're going to build that into sort of the day of action the next day, which is essentially a really large like street carnival, and people are really invited to come.
Great, thank you very much. And back to you, Bob.
Thank you, Alexa. Let's hear from some of our listeners who have written in to share with us some of their ideas on how to survive the meltdown and have a good time doing it. From Anna Olson in Vancouver, she wrote, "To keep gas costs down, I went to the closest dump and rummaged bike parts. I found a bicycle co-op nearby and worked with a group of people to get my bike going, all at no cost. Biking around the city is great. I found a nice community in the bike co-op, and I'm not spending any money on my car, and I'm getting good exercise." What do you think about that, Ornella?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. These kind of opportunities not only keep you fit and are healthy and are great for the environment, but yes, as you know, Anna said, they create community. They get people together. They get people to learn and teach each other and learn from each other so that you can learn how to fix your own bike. You can help someone else. I think a lot of these ways to survive the crisis should be based on knowledge sharing, on helping each other, on developing new forms of solidarity and empathy as well, as you know, as much as we also need to pressure our governments to try and keep our interest, like the citizens' interest, on the agenda more than just the corporations.
Thank you, Ornella. And this email is from Jean-Marc Fournier from St. John's, New Brunswick. "I think building community is key. Buy local, support farmers, find out what your friends are short of and try to help out. Cook with friends instead of going out. Spending time and money in your community builds sustainable relationships. Corporations, large grocery stores, when these go under, they won't care about you." Let us know what you think by emailing us at meltdown@cbc.ca. To finish on a light note, let's find out not only how to survive during the crisis, but also how to stay sexy when times are tough. We'll hear from Alexa interviewing Carlisle Jansen, founder of Good For Her, a feminist-run sex store in downtown Toronto.
Hello, this is Alexa Wright, on-site at Good For Her in downtown Toronto. I'm with Carlisle Jansen, who will be giving us some tips on how to stay sexy when your bank account is dried up. Carlisle, what are some of the creative things we can do to keep our sex lives afloat when the economy is in recession?
Well, the good thing is you always have your body and your body parts that can do whatever they normally do. So you don't have to get fancy when it comes to playing and having fun. You can get a bunch of people together and rent a DVD and have a night of a screening. You can watch either something educational and then share maybe afterwards the things that you learn and other things you might want to try from your own collective experience, or watch some porn and decide what you want to do after that. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have what we would consider feminist porn. So if you haven't tried porn before, it's an interesting way to sort of try porn in a different way if there's something that is important to you about making sure that women are behind the camera or that it shows more diversity, people of color, people of size, that kind of thing. So that's a pretty cheap way to have fun and stay sexy. I would also recommend, we have a workshop called the Love Lab, which is making your own lube and massage oil. So you can learn how to make your own products that you can then make on the cheap in future. And who knows, maybe you could even sell some to your friends. Makes great gifts and really cheap gifts. Along those lines, I would also suggest that one way to stay sexy is to make cards, right? Send cards to the people that you love, and you don't have to buy one. You can make one, and you can do lots of creative things, and people generally prefer to get a homemade card rather than one that was bought at the store.
Now, would these be romance cards?
Yeah.
Would they be confessional cards?
Well, you can make it whatever you want. It could be like, you know, be at my place at 8 o'clock tonight for a good time, or it could be I really love you and these are the many things that I love about you. It could be here's your coupon for one free back massage on Saturday morning, or something, you know.
So
you can get creative with that, and those can be really fun things to do. And you can, you know, either put it in the mail or I suppose you can do lots of things with graphics and email them, or deliver them by bike or by DTC. So those are a couple fun things to do. And then there's lots of people who get together to swap things, right? So there's your traditional clothing exchange, and it gets a little bit tricky around sexuality and toys, but certainly lots of us have lingerie that we don't like anymore, doesn't fit anymore, whatever, like, you know, we used for one time and then we broke up and don't want to be reminded of it anymore, whatever it might be, right? So a sexy swap. If you're going to swap toys, the things you have to obviously be aware of is that you want to buy ones that are silicone so you can boil them. You can use condoms with toys, but those are more choices that you need to make about whether you're wanting to use recycled toys. We are starting to take also toys for people who want to recycle them and they don't know what to do with the toys that's kind of broken. And there is a an organization in Florida that's taking them and like reusing parts and disposing of things in a sanitary way that can't be reused. So you could always bring those in here.
Great.
And certainly if you have batteries that you've used on toys, you can bring them into Good for Her, and we will also make sure that those don't end up in the landfill and take them to a toxic drop-off. So those are other important things.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So it's all about DIY, reusing and recycling. Thank you.
Sharing with others. Sharing the love.
Thanks again to our experts, Rufus Dean, Professor of Political Economy at York University, and sociologist Ornella Dossi from La Sapienza University in Rome. Remember, you can check out more info on surviving the meltdown at www.cbc.ca.